Hey friends, welcome back to Anti-Visions. I know it's been a long while, but this season I'm going to do some things a little bit differently. Last season I laid kind of a foundation for some of the things that I, you know, wanted to discuss in terms of worldviews, different visions of the world that are colliding. And what it boiled down to, the thing that where the rubber really met the road the most is critical race theory became something I ended up talking about a lot, unpacking, you know, talking to some extent in depth about Robin DiAngelo's work, Ibram X. Kendi, and critical race theory, its origins and effects. And so now really what I want to focus on in these coming podcasts is not as much the theory, which I think the theory is very important, but the practice. Because even since I talked about it, and I think the last podcast was back in November, so much has happened and unfolded, and critical race theory has become actually a very mainstream word since then. But it's not just a word, it's something that has been implemented in trainings in HR departments, but especially in the schools. And so that will be a focus of mine, especially is the realm of education, not just university, but especially more like secondary, elementary, public education, and looking more at how these ideas are playing out, not mincing words over, you know, what do we mean by these concepts, but how these concepts are being applied. Because something that is happening currently in the debate about critical race theory is that, it really goes back to when Christopher Rufo was the first investigative reporter that really uncovered a lot of things that were going on and brought it to the public. And then it really gained steam when the Trump administration used that reporting to write an executive order banning all use of critical race theory in diversity trainings. And that was defined by, you know, teaching that America is racist to its core, and, you know, teaching that white people are racist, or teaching concepts like systemic racism. And as you can imagine, that caused some serious backlash, particularly in progressive circles. And, you know, that's a very lucrative industry also. And because the progressive, very political agenda and critical race theory is an ideology, it's a political ideology. And because it had taken such root in so many areas of our government, meaning that they've been bringing in and paying big bucks to have, weekend trainings, some of them even 2-week trainings, and just massive amounts of money. And then all of a sudden, they weren't allowed to contract anyone from these businesses. Now, what was said immediately to the public is that the Trump administration, of course, because of their xenophobia and racism and all of this stuff, will not allow diversity training. And that is not at all what was said. It's particular teachings and maxims of critical race theory, and they defined it in the executive order and said if those things are being taught, or if someone is hired that uses that ideology, that they're known for using it, they cannot contract. But, you know, multicultural education or training, diversity training, has been around for a long time. You know, I've been through many courses of it years ago as a professional, long before I ever heard of critical race theory, and never once encountered anything like what I'm hearing right now. So they were not saying that there can't be diversity training, but that is the way that the pushback comes, is to misrepresent and to bank on ignorance, to bank on the idea that people are going to take the media's word, because the media has become the mouthpiece of the progressive government, really, in many ways. I wouldn't say there's really a free press anymore, in the sense that the most of the media, corporate media, has chosen willfully to become a mouthpiece of the government. And so there's this banking on the idea that the American people are just going to listen to what we say rather than go read up on it for themselves and go find out what is it for the, you know, what is it saying? What is critical race theory? What was banned in the executive order? Now there's all kind of legislation being written by several states. As a matter of fact, I think up to 20 states have been writing their own legislation. Several of them have passed it already. And none of them say that you can't talk about slavery or that you can't talk about our history, our sordid history as America. But that has been the strategy of the far left, is to say that there's an attempt to whitewash America's history. There's an attempt to cover up our history and not be open about, you know, what has happened in terms of slavery and oppression of especially African Americans, which is simply not true, not the case. But that's what they're saying. When anyone opposes critical race theory, that's been the accusation, in especially in the public, in the media, and from leftist politicians, is to say, hey, these right-wingers, these conservatives, because they want to box you in, when there are people that are not right-wing and not conservative who are opposing critical race theory as well, but they want to box you into that, and they're going to say, you just want to whitewash our history. You don't want to have open and honest dialogue. Then they say, you're politicizing it. So that has been something that recently I've seen in several news outlets. They've been talking about how the Republicans have, you know, chosen, which again, it's kind of funny saying Republicans, because there are a lot of Republicans that are opposing CRT, but that opposition is not owned by Republicans, but they want it to be political because the ideology is political in and of itself. It has no place in our schools, especially because it is a complete one-sided biased ideology that's political. And yet those who oppose it are being accused of politicizing it. So that's the way that they deal with it. They don't deal with the reality. And then they tell Americans, no, well, that's now the message has been, well, whatever the conservatives are saying, whatever Christopher Rufo is saying, which I'm not even sure that he's really a conservative, maybe he is, but you know, you can listen to Dave Rubin, you can listen to others who Brett Weinstein, who don't consider themselves, you know, conservatives, or at least on the right, and they oppose critical race theory anyway. What they want to say now is, you don't even know what critical race theory is. So just the other day, you know, Christopher Rufo was drug on MSNBC with Joy Reid, and she was accusing him of not knowing what critical race theory is, when he's one of, in many ways, one of the most authoritative voices on it, at least leading the opposition. So her goal was just to delegitimize all of his authority and accuse him of not understanding what critical race theory is. But the interesting thing is, on the flip side, she, as well as any other news outlet or progressive media that I've seen as of late, not only do they accuse the right of not understanding critical race theory, what they say is critical race theory is not being taught in schools. So even though it is being taught in schools, they say it isn't. So they say, even though your eyes, you know, you could see that it's happening, and even though you know, don't trust your eyes, trust what we tell you. And that's really what's going on here. They're playing semantics and mincing words so that, you know, they say, well, critical race theory is, you know, it was born in the law schools, in Harvard, and it was. But it has grown and it has morphed. And so they say, well, it's only taught in law schools in at the grad level. It's not being taught in elementary schools. Well, that's just a lie, because it's being implemented. Okay, so you can debate whether it's being taught or not, but all of those concepts are being implemented in the elementary schools. It's something that's being practiced, not taught. The theory isn't being taught. And aside from that, I don't you know, my last podcast season was really focused on all of the theory. And the reality is that critical race theory has grown into multiple disciplines. It has morphed over time. There are many other studies that are under its umbrella, and it has spun off. So they're lying to the public. They're telling the truth, saying, yes, it started in Harvard Law School, but they want to say that's really where it is still. And so this is just a big boogeyman that the conservatives have made up. Okay, so what I think is, or also, you know, the other basic accusations earlier on that haven't worked so well is saying you're racist. That's why you're against critical race theory. But what I want to focus on is the practical. Like, rather than talking about theory and debating it, we know what is being implemented, what kind of curriculums, what those curriculums say, what teachers are saying in schools, and whatever you call it, it doesn't really matter. You know, I'm gonna take this one from Jesus. He said, you can know a tree by its fruit. And we know what the fruit is. So I want to look at the fruit. I don't want to debate on what the name of the tree is. If it's an acorn, you can argue that it didn't come from an oak tree. You can argue that it's a willow tree. You can argue that it's a made-up name tree. I don't care. It doesn't really matter. The acorn is the acorn. You can rename the acorn, but in the end, the acorn is still an acorn. An apple, that fruit is an apple. It doesn't change even if you rename it. And that's what critical theory does constantly to lock and tie people up in language and debate in order to hold power. That's a Foucault idea, kind of like what we're going to do is we're going to take control of the situation by endlessly debating over words. And every time you finally understand what we're saying, we're going to change the name or we're going to change the meaning so that we can continually hold the power because we're going to rule the conversation. That's their goal. So my idea is let's just look at the actual fruit. Let's just look at it. If the fruit is poisonous, I don't care if you rename the tree. I don't care if you rename the fruit. The fruit looks the same, it tastes the same, and it does the same job. It's poisonous. So I'm going to take an article by Christopher Rufo, and I think I'm going to do this quite a bit for the next several podcasts, or at least quite a bit this season, and just take different articles that I see published, and several from Christopher Rufo, and just read them, and also, you know, comment on them a little bit. But I'm going to read them just because these in particular have to do with what's going on in education. And I want my friends who are listening to know what's going on. Rather than listening to Joy Reid or whoever is, you know, talking, Brian Stelter, or whoever's on TV, whether they're on the right or the left, it doesn't matter. The big old debate of philosophy over CRT and systemic racism and all of these buzzwords, well, that can just go on all day. But what we need to know is what's actually happening and how is it affecting our kids, especially how is it affecting our schools? This one is from Christopher Rufo in City Journal called The Merchants of Revolution. And he published it on April 13th, 2021. And this one is about California. Now, he's got a lot about different parts of the country. Okay. So, you know, we can only guess that things probably are pretty radical in California, but it appears that these days California is becoming the template for the rest of the country. So we would do well to pay attention. Plus, some of the things that we're finding, you know, that you'll hear about will have an impact on the country because, you know, California produces kids who influence our nation just like any other state does. So it matters to the entire republic. So Christopher says, California public schools are embarking on a new experiment, education as social justice. Earlier this year, the State Department of Education approved an ethnic studies model curriculum, and individual school districts have begun to implement programs that advocate decolonizing the United States and liberating, quote-unquote, liberating students from capitalism, patriarchy, and settler colonialism. I'm just going to pause there. Now, I'm not going to go into all the things, especially colonialism, decolonizing. Yeah, I talked about the philosophy of this stuff in past podcasts. So if you're familiar with postmodernism, critical theory, and now critical race theory, then you'll know what these buzzwords are. And the other point I want to make is that this, when he was writing this, it had not been passed yet. But since then, California has voted and this curriculum has been passed. And all the school districts have a choice whether they're going to use it or to whatever extent. But many throughout California are using it. And in my opinion, one is too many. So if you, I guess I'll just keep going here. This is what Christopher says. This will likely come as a surprise to most California residents who may be familiar with the movement's euphemisms, quote-unquote ethnic studies, quote-unquote educational equity, quote-unquote culturally responsive teaching, but do not understand the philosophical and political premises of these programs. I'm going to pause there. This is an important point because Christopher is saying that many California residents, and he was right, and there are probably many that still don't know, will be surprised to know what's inside the curriculum. See, it doesn't matter what's on the cover of the book. You know, you pretend the curriculum is a book and you've got a cover and you got a picture and you've got a name on it. It doesn't matter what's on the cover. What matters is inside, what's inside. And what has begun to happen, especially with critical race theory in the realm of education, is that, like you said, euphemisms are used to hide what's being taught. It's not just the connection to critical race theory. They used to not fear that because nobody even knew what the heck it was. I mean, most people didn't in the mainstream. But they knew that the basic concepts where the rubber meets the road would be offensive as well. So they're going to say ethnic studies. Well, what's wrong with ethnic studies? That doesn't sound like a bad thing to me. It doesn't have to be a bad thing, okay? But when you infuse it, when you inject it with critical race theory, which is sort of a neo-Marxist or neo-neo-Marxist, or it needs a new name, but it's a completely different system of thought and value than anything you would most likely want to teach your children. And if at all, you should at least have a choice in it. And then they say educational equity. Oh, that sounds wonderful, doesn't it? Educational equity. Yes, we want equity. Well, I want to argue, no, you don't want equity. Equity they've developed a meaning that's very specific about equity. And I can say confidently that equity is the enemy of equality. So equality, like equal opportunity, we're all equal in the eyes of God. We should all be treated equally, regardless of our skin color, regardless of our religion, regardless of our race, regardless of all those things, you know, like the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the very things especially that Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement were pushing for was equality. You know, African-American men standing with a sign saying, I am a man. You know, the fight to be equal, okay? And what they want to do is equality is a bad word to them. Now, they're not going to tell you that. That's deep embedded in the book. On the cover, it's just going to say equity. And then our ears hear it and we go, oh yeah, equity. Yeah. I mean, like I got equity in my home. That's a good thing. Right. And equity is, it sounds good. Sounds like equality. And no. They have redefined the word equity and it's very specific. It means not equal opportunity. It means equal outcome. And you have to understand when you radically pursue that equal outcome, like the idea is that everybody makes the same amount of money, that everybody could work the same job. It doesn't matter how hard you worked, how smart you are. It doesn't matter if you worked really, really hard to build that business. You don't deserve that business. The other guy deserves that business. Or you don't deserve that degree. Or you don't deserve that spot on the team because we don't want anybody to be ahead. I mean, it's Harrison Bergeron on steroids. If you've ever read Kurt Vonnegut's story, it's a short story. I recommend reading it because it's exactly what's going on. So that is equity. Equity is equal outcome. And in order to affect equity, you have to have absolute control, because you have to usurp people's desires, people's motivations, people's smarts or their strengths, all of those things that create what they call inequities. And you have to also remove equal opportunity. Okay. And that's something that Ibram Kendi argues for in his book, you know, that if it's discrimination, that basically what he calls is anti-racist, then it's good discrimination. Okay. So the idea is equality is bad because equality, especially equal opportunity, isn't fair because there are certain people that already have, think about it, like if you get on a sports team, there are people that are probably just going to be, you know, going back to when I was a teenager, some would be more athletic than me. And we both had equal opportunity, equal access, but that kid that just, man, he's just killing it in every single way, didn't matter. He was going to excel and move up and get the, you know, the starting position eventually on the teams and maybe even go on and play college. And in the world of equity, that's not fair because he had an inherent strength. You see, equity is not just about, it's not just about economics. There's inequities within families. You get three siblings together and you can see one of them might be smarter than the rest of them. One of them might be stronger than the rest of them. One of them might be, you know, more artistic or musical than the rest of them. Those are inequities. Are they bad inequities? I wouldn't really argue so. Is it because the parents are racist or because the parents cared about one child more than another? No, any rational parent who actually has children knows that that's not the case. Those inequities exist because they are individual human beings with individual genetic codes that and strengths and, you know, just God-given abilities and uniqueness that no one else has. So I did do a podcast on equality and equity, and that's a major part of this. So my point here is that Christopher Rufo is saying, hey, you know, just because they say culturally responsive teaching sounds like a great thing, but you need to look inside the book, read what's in the curriculum, what are the specifics they're saying, and like he says, many California residents would be shocked or surprised or disgusted at what their children are being taught or is in process to be implemented in the schools so that they will be taught these things. So he says, I'm going to go on. He says, I have obtained documents from one such program, the Santa Clara County Office in Education's Ethnic Studies Initiative, that paint a disturbing picture of the ethnic studies curriculum and the activists leading the charge. According to the documents and to the sources within the district, the Office of Education held a series of teacher training sessions on how to deploy ethnic studies in the classroom. The leaders, including district staff, an advisor for the state ethnic studies model curriculum, and a professor from San Jose State University, encouraged teachers to inject left-wing politics into the classroom and to hide controversial materials from parents. He goes on to say, according to slides and contemporaneous notes from the session, the Santa Clara Office of Education began the presentation with a quote-unquote land acknowledgement, claiming that Santa Clara County and the public school system, quote, occupy the unceded territory of the Muwekma Ohlone Nation, the sovereign nation and original people of the skies, land, and waters, close quote. Now, the premise, Christopher says, of this ritual, which has become common in progressive organizations, talking about the land acknowledgement ritual. It's something that, especially on the West Coast, you'll hear about it, like in Portland, you know, as you can only imagine, places like that will start their meetings or presentations with a land acknowledgement, acknowledging that they're on stolen land. Christopher says that the premise is that the American government, founded by white settlers, is an illegitimate colonial power that should return the land to the Native American tribes. Now, I just want to comment and say, you know, if that's your belief, that's fine. You know, this is America. You are allowed to believe those things. But I do not believe it's okay to teach that idea as truth in schools to children. Okay. Aside from the fact that I don't have time to go into it, but when you look at history, this is based so much of critical race theory and the history around it. So like even Ibram Kendi, he calls himself a historian. So much of his history is based on, it's like a romantic history, or maybe you could call it fantasy. It's sort of this one, you know, fantastic idea that everything was wonderful and beautiful and glorious and every other culture was amazing, but it was those white Europeans that decided to be greedy and, you know, to colonialize and to oppress people and to take slaves and all of this stuff. So, you know, how does that relate to the Native Americans? Absolutely. If you read the history, there are some terrible things that happened with Native Americans. I am not in any way trying to diminish that. But what I am saying is that when you read world history, you discover that there really is nowhere where anyone is living that isn't quote unquote stolen land. You know, that there is a history. Go back to Britain. There was a time where almost every century there were new invaders that came from abroad, came from somewhere in Europe, came across the channel and invaded and conquered different parts of Britain. So, and it happened over and over and over again. And when those invaders, who were the radical barbarians at the time, came in, then they settled down, they integrate in, and 100 years later, they're the ones that are getting conquered by somebody else. And that is the history of humanity. It's the history of Africa. It's also the history of America before any Europeans ever came. So any, you know, Native American tribes that are in different areas, at one time, they had a turf war and they took over the land. So whose land is it really? We don't even know. If we're going to live that way, everybody needs to be a refugee. Everybody in every part of the world needs to uproot because they don't have a legitimate claim on the land. If that's the way we're going to act, the reality is that it's not the way that we behave today, but it does happen in many parts of the world, and I'm afraid we could devolve into that again. But those were people of their time, and that's just the way things happened. I mean, you can't change that. And that's the claim here, is that, you know, that conservatives or those that resist CRT don't want to talk about history, when really what I see is postmodern revisionist historians, including critical race theorists who also take much interest in history. And I see them wanting to fantasize about history, to want to only focus on certain things and to ignore broader history, ignore world history. And that's another point that I could get caught up on, but I'll say in my last season, I read an essay by Thomas Sowell called The Real History of Slavery, and it covers a lot of that. We have to realize that a lot of the rhetoric from especially critical race theory is hyper-Western Anglo-it's focused on us, as though America is the center of the world. As much as they tend to hate America, they still make American history the center of the world, as though none of these things were happening before. Slavery is an institution that was practiced in every part of the world. The Muslim world actually ran more slaves to the Atlantic slave trade than the West. So if we really care about oppression and we really care about all of this, why? Well, I guess that's Islamophobia if I say that. What about China? China, just as many slaves in Brazil, just as a matter of fact, more slaves went there than to the colonies here. So, you know, there isn't a real, it's not honest. There's not an honest spirit about it. And that's what I want to see is honesty. So let me get back to this article. I am just going to focus on a few more things. That was a little soapbox there, but he says next, Christopher says next, George Pacheco, the president of the California Latino School Boards Association and advisor for the state ethnic studies model curriculum, presented the movement's conceptual framework. Pacheco explained that the ethnic studies curriculum is based on the work of Brazilian Marxist Paulo Freire, who invented the concept of the pedagogy of the oppressed, which holds that students must be educated to understand their oppression and develop the practical skills, or praxis, to challenge and eventually overthrow their oppressors. Okay, I'm going to stop there. You hear oftentimes, and I think too much, conservatives bring up, well, you know, this is a Marxist, and Marxism is, there is an element of Marxism in this. And yes, the great grandfather, or maybe great great grandfather of critical race theory is Marxism. But of course, on the left and in the media, they just mock it and say, oh, they're always bringing up Marxism and oh, blah, blah, blah. And who cares? And, you know, we even had one of our highest ranking military officials the other day in a congressional hearing saying, well, I've read Karl Marx. Well, I have too. But I don't teach Karl Marx's truth in the schools. There's a big difference. I do believe that we should, yes, at a certain point in time when kids are ready, not in kindergarten, first grade, second, maybe even third, we should be introducing students to all kinds of ideas, but they should see both sides. They should see the pro and the con. But this is a very specific ideology, and any opposition is to be shut down. And that's why they're canceling certain kind of books in the schools. They're canceling names of schools. They're canceling statues because you're not allowed to even talk about it. So who's the one that doesn't want to talk about history? You're not even allowed. But the only way to really ensure that someone knows what they believe is to give them not only one side of the argument, but the other. Because one side of the argument always sounds great until it's cross-examined by its opposition. Okay, so that's what I see going on here. The American way is to present ideas, to critically analyze, and to debate those ideas. Of course, if we're talking about education, it should be at a developmentally appropriate pace for students. Nonetheless, we want to get people to where they are, you know, where they're able to think critically. Well, critical race theory it's about thinking critically. No, it's not. It's about being critical. It's about being full of resentment. It's about finding the bad in every single thing and only focusing on those bad things. That's the kind of critical, you know, when somebody's really critical and you don't enjoy being around them, that's not a good critical. Critical thinking is good because you're able to take two ideas. As a matter of fact, a good critical thinker will actually go and seek out the opposing viewpoint. So when there's something that I really strongly believe, what I want to do is I want to go and I want to find out what the opposition is saying. And I don't want to find a straw man argument. I want to find what is the best argument out there. And I do that with all kinds of things. I want to know what is the best, the loudest voice, not just the loudest, but the person with the most authority and the thing that's said repetitively about whatever it is. You know, something I really like to get into is apologetics and theology and all those kind of things. So it's fun for me. I like to hear the debates. I like to hear debates about science. And that's interesting, isn't it, that there's debate in science. They talk about it like it's a monolith. Well, that's just a side point. But anyway, what I'm saying here, I'll get back to this, that this study was based on the pedagogy of the oppressed from a Brazilian Marxist. And there's this, whenever it gets exposed, like, hey, you know, they're teaching the pedagogy of the oppressed, like I said, the liberal leftist media and others just scoff and mock and say, ha, no, that's not the case. There's nothing to worry about. And anyway, I'll leave it at that. So he says, Christopher, in his article, says that Pacheco did acknowledge that the Marxist underpinnings to ethnic studies scare people away, but insisted that teachers must be, quote, grounded in the correct politics to educate students. Pause. Wait a minute. Teachers need to be grounded in the correct politics. That is absolutely un-American. It's just so silly when I think about it, because I hear these constant rants about, you know, how our democracy is in danger. And not only that, it's white supremacists who are opposing critical race theory. And it's, you know, these crazy people on the conservative side. Well, wait a minute. If that's the way this is going to work, and we're going to tell our teachers and we're going to tell our students that there's only one political way to think, then what we're going to do is create a world where there's only one party, there's only one thought. There is no choice. I don't care if you call yourself a democracy anymore, which we're not actually a democracy, we're a republic. But anyway, a democracy, you can call yourself a democracy all you want, but if there's nothing to choose from, then, well, it's not a democracy. So it's, again, remarkable to me that you're saying that teachers, no, as a matter of fact, teachers should not be bringing their politics in the classroom. In the same way that they shouldn't be bringing their religion in the classroom, that you're being told, well, you can't, you know, as a Christian, you can't stand up and just preach the gospel in front of the classroom. Well, then you shouldn't be able to stand up and preach your bent on politics either. Now, can you teach what's going on in the world? Can you teach about politics? Yes, but it's a very different thing. And he's saying, this leader is saying, hey, you know, you've got to be grounded in the right politics. And we know which politics that is, right? Wink, wink. So Pacheco then argued that the United States is a political regime based on settler colonialism, which he describes as a system of oppression that occupies and usurps land, labor, resources from one group of people for the benefit of another. The settler colonialist regime, Pacheco continues, is not just a vicious thing of the past, but one that exists as long as settlers are living on appropriated land. So he's saying, we're not just talking about history. We live in a highly oppressive society where we are occupying, you know, like an apartheid state or something, or even worse. I mean, we are occupying someone else's land. And so the system of oppression is going on. And then he goes on and he calls the United States a parasitic system. So at this point, we should not be allowing this guy to write curriculum for students in public schools in the United States of America, unless we want to be the United States of anti-America. It's just astounding, you know, that of course there are instances of oppression in our society today. You know, people get oppressed all the time, but on a global scale, you have to ask yourself, why do people from all over the world still itch and scratch and bang at our doors trying to get into this country? Why do people from other nations, whether it's from Africa or South America or, you know, from Asia, I've heard from China, from Russia, we have so many from all over the world that will say, this is the greatest country to live in. Why didn't they go somewhere else? Is this really the most oppressive? Because the question isn't perfection. That's a ridiculous and fantastical idea. There is no perfection. The question is just which one's the best, which one works the most, not which one has oppression, but which country is the least oppressive, which country gives you the most opportunity. Those are your only real options. So He even says, you know, that in our country, men exploit women. They say white people exploiting people of color. There's rich people exploiting poor people. So what's the solution? Pacheco argues that teachers must awaken students to oppression and lead them to decodify and eventually destroy, quote-unquote destroy, the dominant political regime. The first step in this process is to help students get into the mind of a white man, such as Christopher Columbus, and analyze, quote-unquote, what ideology led these white male settlers to be power and land hungry and justify stealing indigenous land through genocide, end quote. What ideology? Now, of course, we're not supposed to recognize the fact that this is actually an ideology that's posing this question. But also, what kind of conclusions could you come to? White people are bad. Europeans are bad. Western civilization is bad. But if we're talking about ideology, is that insinuating maybe that even Jewishness and Christianity, because of the impact it had on Western civilization, that ideology is bad as well? Maybe I'm reading into it too much, but it seems like that idea pops up all too often when I read about CRT and where the rubber meets the road, the kind of things that are said. He didn't say it here, but I'm just saying. Pacheco describes this process as transforming students into activist intellectuals who decodify systems of oppression into their component parts, including white supremacy, patriarchy, classism, genocide, private property, and God. Oh, wow, there it is. It came up. I actually wasn't expecting that. So let me point out, I just want to point this out. He's saying that our job as educators, I am an educator in public education. He's saying our job is to transform students into activist intellectuals. And I think we should run from this guy. Never allow him around a school or around a child. That is not the job of any conscientious educator. And it should not be the job of any, there should be no educator in this country that's employed by a local government or a state government or the federal government for that matter that has this philosophy. Because to raise up activists, you have to indoctrinate them. You have to be ideological and tell them this is the truth. It's dogmatic and this is the way it is. So you take your student and you tell them what to think. And that's it. You don't give them the opposition. You tell them what to think, and you tell them you go out there and you make sure this happens, right? No, our job is to actually mature students to a point where they are competent enough intellectually to think for themselves, to take information and to come to their own conclusions and be able to justify those conclusions so that in a good debate, you could actually hear two different sides and both of them have good justifications, right? I don't want to teach kids this is exactly what you have to think and this is the way you must think. That is what this guy's vision is, transforming students into activist intellectuals. He says, he even went on and he said, this is amazing, teachers must be careful, though. Pacheco and the other panelists suggested that local educators hide, you hear that? Hide this revolutionary pedagogy from administrators and families. Now, sadly enough, this is my comment. Sadly enough, many administrators throughout the country have embraced this pedagogy as well. But this attempt to hide it from families is going on from west to east coast. And that's not a conspiracy, it's a fact. Look up Loudoun County right now. Anyway, so here's a quote from in the paper that I'm reading. Quote, district guidelines and expectations are barriers, said one panelist. Quote, we have to be extra careful about what is being said since we can't just say something controversial now that we're in people's homes because of remote learning. End quote. So they're discussing how to subtly and deceptively teach this. Why? because they know that it's controversial. So now that it's COVID, which is when this panel happened, well, we need to be careful so that parents don't actually hear what we're teaching. No, it should be known. Any parent should know exactly. And the first teacher of students is not the teacher of the state or the teacher of record. It's the parent. And we're moving into, and it's kind of scary. So you might be listening and not agree with what I'm saying, but in terms of critical race theory, but you should be concerned about the attempt to make children the subject of the state with more authority in the state than there is in the parent. And that is embedded in this whole movement. Okay, so he says, Christopher goes on, he says, in addition, teachers must acknowledge that they too can become oppressors in the classroom. Inherently, it's the oppressor who sets the rules. Teachers must recognize their own privilege and their own bias in order to align themselves with the oppressed and work toward dismantling systems of oppression. The goal, according to the presenters, is to, quote, develop, pilot, and refine an adaptable and scalable ethnic studies program, design plan, and curriculum that can serve as standalone courses or be integrated into core content areas. End quote. This is already happening, says Christopher. Last month, which would have been March, the California Department of Education approved the statewide curriculum, which will bring the pedagogy of the oppressed to schools throughout the state. But for the movement's leaders, the goal is to go further. At the end of the presentation in Santa Clara, Pacheco argued that schools should start transforming children into activist intellectuals, beginning in first grade. It's never too young, he said. We should be cashing in on kids' inherent empathy in order to reshape their ideological foundations. And I might add, in order to turn these children against their parents, to send them home and tell their parents how racist they are or how wrong they are, because it's not actually about your color. You have to understand, if you embrace the right ideology and you're white, if you're woke and you're white, you can be good to go, thumbs up. I mean, as long as you keep a repentant spirit, right, and you just keep confessing how terrible you are, you've got a thumbs up. But if you're black and you're a conservative, if you're black and you don't agree with this ideology, well, then you yourself have been duped. You are not awake. You're asleep. You're a sleepwalker, and you've been brainwashed and enculturated into the system of oppression, and you've internalized it. So, you know, you're actually agreeing with white supremacy, even though you're black. So what they're saying is, you have to think the way that we say you have to think. And if you're black, you're not free to think any which way you want. I mean, if you want our thumbs up, you have to think the way we think. You can't be a free thinker. You can't actually think you know yourself. We'll tell you who you are. We'll tell you what's Freudian and what's not. We'll tell you what's in your soul, and we'll tell you what to think. And you better not disagree with it. That's what this really comes down to. It's not about race. It's about an ideology. And the ideology is exalted above everything else, including people's race. But it is used to divide people by race and to turn people against one another, to cause resentment against one another, hatred, self-hatred, hatred of our country, hatred of our government. Anyway. So, like Christopher says, I mean, I couldn't say it better. He says, this is a dystopian project. As these pedagogical theories make their way into the classroom, California schools will be teaching millions of children to hate their own country. They will be oriented toward the work of decolonizing, deconstructing, and dismantling their own society. The ethnic studies activists grasp the destabilizing nature of their project and believe that it provides them leverage for their broader political ends. During the Santa Clara presentation, Pacheco and the other instructors provided the audience with a handout quoting Freire. Quote, critical consciousness, they say, is anarchic. Others add that critical consciousness may lead to disorder. Some, however, confess, "Why deny it? I was afraid of freedom. I am no longer afraid." Okay, so I gotta stop there. So they're saying that chaos and anarchy, disorder, and might I add, that would include lawlessness, as you can see. Like still today in Portland, there are still riots, Antifa riots, to this day, almost every night in Portland. I don't even know how the city's still standing. And well, they also riot in other cities as well. But what they're saying is that true freedom is anarchy. True freedom is when you overthrow. So when we destabilize, but you know, that's mistaken. That's an understatement. Any revolution, any destabilized society in history, or anyone who's been through it, which I haven't, but I don't want to, knows that it's extremely bloody. Many people lose their loved ones. Life changes drastically. If they're claiming that they're fighting for a quality of life for people who have been oppressed, they're lying, lying through their teeth, because this is not going to give a quality of life. It would, I'm not saying it will really happen, but it would decimate everything that we know of our society. So let me end it with this. Christopher says, though they are coy about their ultimate intention, the ethnic studies activists seek, at a minimum, a moral revolution. And out of such tumults, political revolutions often follow. California voters may not realize it, but they have installed a radical movement in the state educational bureaucracy. So that ends the article. I'm going to post a link to it, and see you next time.